His partner, Andrew Sandy Irvin, a relative novice at 22, still an undergraduate at Oxford, had nonetheless proven himself the perfect acolyte in this quest for an Alpine Grail. What the leader of the 1924 expedition on which Mallory and Irvin were lost wrote afterward rings true today. Mallory was the greatest antagonist that Everest has had or is like to have. And Irvin, though destined ever after to languish in the shade of Mallory's fame, remains, in the vignette of another teammate, the epitome of the natural adept he could follow, if not lead, anywhere. At 12:50 on the afternoon of June 8, 1924, climbing solo to 26,000 feet in support of the summit duo, Noel O'Dell saw the clouds part briefly, giving him a fugitive glimpse of a pair of figures far above him, outlined against the sky, moving expeditiously over a steep step of rock and ice on the northeast ridge, less than 1,000 feet below the top. This has come down to us as perhaps the most haunting sighting in the annals of exploration. Then the clouds closed in, and Mallory and Irvin vanished into history. With the sole exception of Amelia Earhart, no lost explorer in the 20th century has provoked a more intense outpouring of romantic speculation than George Mallory. The question of what happened to him and his young companion, of how those two brave men met their fate, is naughty enough. What spurs the imagination to a higher flight is the possibility that they might have reached Everest's summit before they died, 29 years before Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay made the mountain's official first ascent. If Mallory and Irvin had succeeded, they could have laid fair claim to having pulled off the greatest mountaineering feat ever performed. Thus, the mystery of Mallory and Irvin was handed down to all later generations of climbers. But for me, at age 18, the conundrum took on a more personal dimension. As a freshman at Harvard, I drifted into the circle of the university's mountaineering club, which at the time comprised the most accomplished gang of college climbers in the country. Among the six or seven especially talented and flamboyant upperclassmen, one in particular became first my hero, then my mentor, and then my friend and partner. Scraggly bearded, soft-spoken, quicksilver smart, slyly iconoclastic, brilliant on vertical rock and ice, absent-minded as a dreamy preschooler, Rick Milliken seemed cut from a Viking mold. On an autumn weekend at the Shawangunks in New York State, Rick dragged me up the hardest and most exhilarating rock pitch I had yet tackled. That January, he broke trail along the frozen crest of New Hampshire's Presidential Range as I struggled to keep up in a -30-degree Fahrenheit gale. Sometime during that freshman year, I learned that Rick was George Mallory's grandson. Born in 1941, Rick, of course, had never known his illustrious forebear. His mother, Claire, the eldest of Mallory's three children, had been eight when her father disappeared. She remembered much about him, and she passed down her stories to her three sons. As Rick and I became good friends, we sometimes talked about Mallory. He believed his grandfather had summited that June day so long ago. Pressed for a rationale, he fell back on intuition. "Those guys were good," he said, if memory serves. "They knew what they were doing up there." Rick's other grandfather was Robert Millikan, who had won the 1923 Nobel Prize in Physics. Claire Mallory had married Robert Millikan's son, Glenn, only to watch, one day in 1947, as her husband was killed as he stood beside her, in a climbing accident in the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee. I knew little more about this catastrophe than the bare facts. Rick's father had been hit on the head by a falling stone. He had died instantly. At 20, I was too shy and awkward to probe further or to ask Rick to recount the mishap that had cost him his father at an even younger age than Claire had lost hers. What seemed remarkable, though, was that despite the twin tragedies of her life, Claire had not only tolerated her son's embrace of this most dangerous sport, she had taught them to climb and heartily encouraged their alpine play. On my first